At the stroke of the midnight hour, when the world sleeps, India will awake to life and freedom.
Free India. The rise of public sector giants, or temples of modern India, as Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, our first Prime Minister, called them. But the changing landscape did not kill the spirit of private enterprise. In the first part of our two-part Independence Day special, you heard the story of Phenolex and its patriarch Pralhad Chhabria. And in this episode, we delve deeper into the lives and times of the many others. How did the partition affect them? Who stayed back and who left? What was it like to do business in a newly independent India? Did people forget the fissures that the British left behind? To find out all of this and more, we speak to ET's Vikram Doctor. It's Monday, the 15th of August. I'm your host, Diya Riki, and you are listening to Business Bazigars, an Independence Day special episode on The Morning Brief. Thank you so much, Vikram, for joining us on The Morning Brief and taking time.
Well, I'm happy to join. This is actually a fascinating subject about how partition affected the business community, and it's something that is surprisingly little written about.
So could you give our listeners an idea of how Indian businesses really coped through that period of partition? And even when we speak about the stakes, what was at stake on both sides?
When I first wrote about this for the Economic Times, now I think many years back, what surprised me was that there was actually very little information. There were a few memoirs, like the most moving memoir was by Prakash Tandon, who would become the first Indian chairman of Hindustan Lever. And there was a few academics writing. Dr. Vijender Tripathi of Indian Institute of Management, Ahmedabad, did write a little bit about how partition affected Indian business. But actually, there was relatively little, especially compared to how much has been written about the political and social consequences of partition. One perhaps surprising conclusion to come from that was actually the impact was not that much. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is partly, and this is something the Muslim League did find a problem, was that economic development in undivided India was not very evenly distributed. And as it happens, the regions that were Muslim dominant and which would go to East and West Pakistan were comparatively low industrialized regions. They were mainly agricultural regions, and they produced huge amounts of agricultural commodities, wheat from Punjab, rice to some extent, jute in particular from what is now Bangladesh, but was then East Pakistan. But the industries were mostly in what would be India. So for instance, with the jute mills, the jute was grown in what would become East Pakistan, but the jute mills were nearly all in what would become West Bengal. And this was actually a source of some dissatisfaction with the Muslim League, and one of the reasons why they felt that they needed a separate country, because they felt that the business networks, which tended to be dominated by a few mostly Hindu or also Parsi communities, excluding the Muslims to some extent. There are a few examples to the contrary. I mean, possibly the best known is Mahindra and Mohammed, which later became Mahindra and Mahindra, where pre-partition, it actually did consist of a partnership between a Hindu family and a Muslim family. And that did break up post-partition and became Mahindra and Mahindra in India. And Ghulam Muhammad, who was the Muslim partner, went to Pakistan and actually, I think, became the president of Pakistan at some point. But that is very much the exception. By and large, Muslims were involved with growing agro-commodities. And that was a problem for businesses. Like, suddenly, all the jute mills found themselves cut off from the sources of jute. And perhaps to some extent, the Muslim League felt that this was going to be an advantage for Pakistan. And, you know, one example of this is that in the seal of Pakistan, like we have in India, we have the Ashoka Lions on our seal. But the Pakistan seal actually has agro-commodities. It has tea, it has cotton, it has jute, and it has wheat. And, you know, that shows how important these were for Pakistan.
Sure. One of the things that you spoke about while giving this answer also was about your article in ET, which I read and absolutely was mind blown in a sense, because it's such a lovely article. But in that article, you mentioned that there was, you know, three categories of business people in a sense. Could you tell us a little bit more about what these three categories were? And did they see merit in the idea of having two separate countries in a sense?
Well, you know, to some extent, the entire business community in India was kept at arm's length from the administration of India. And that was done very deliberately by the British. The British had this strong hierarchical system where at the top were like the administrators, the bureaucrats, the ICS people, the viceroy and his team. Then came the military. And then came at quite a distance down the hierarchy came what were called the boxwalas, the business people. So the business people did not feel themselves as closely tied to this great imperial project. So one large community among the business people were the British, the managing agencies, the British companies like Hindustan Lever and so on, for who actually saw very little changing. They saw themselves being relatively unaffected by partition and that they would just continue doing business. They were not going to leave. Keep that in mind. The administrative and the military structure of the British Raj were going to leave India. But the British business community saw no reason to leave India. They, in fact, the Congress and in Pakistan, the Muslim League sort of really asked them to stay because they knew they would need their expertise to run the business of the country. And it was not seen as a threat to Indian or Pakistani nationalism. So to some extent, the British business community was sort of blasé. They were like, yes, there will be some, you know, chaos outside in a few places, etc. But by and large, we will continue going on. Then there were the very large chunk of the Indian business community who are not in North India. And you know, this is going to sound a bit callous when I say this, because partitionist was such a horrific and terrible event. Yet, it's important to recognize that there were very large chunks of India that were not affected by this at all. Partition was mainly an event that affected Northwest India in Punjab and Northeast India in Bengal. But across the rest of the country, especially in South India, there was actually very little effect. And these people, these businessmen, like in the big business centers, which happen to be in these areas, like Madras or Bangalore to some extent, Bombay, even Bombay and Ahmedabad, I mean, were really not that affected by partition. And finally, there were a few business people who had close connections to those areas, people like Lala Sriram in Punjab and a whole range of Bengali businessmen and Jain businessmen, Marwari Jain businessmen in Calcutta. And their reactions were more mixed. I mean, many of them were apprehensive and many of them were emotionally distraught. Like Prakash Tandon personally was emotionally distraught because he was working for a British company, Unilever, who was really uninterested in partition. They thought there would be some chaos and they would get on. But he himself was from what was now going to be Pakistan, from a city called Gujarat, which is not a state, it's a city in Pakistani Punjab. And he was distraught. And, you know, that's why that makes his memoir, Punjabi Century, such a rare and fascinating memoir of what it was like for a Punjabi business person to be caught in the reality of partition. But by and large, many business people really did not see themselves getting deeply affected by it. There were some who actually felt they would be affected by independence entirely, and they left India pre-independence. Mainly, that's the Sassoons, who were a very big Baghdadi Jewish family who had many business interests in India, and they actually left India completely pre-independence. But by and large, most of the foreign business community stayed. They would leave India much later on in the 1960s with the devaluation of the rupee and Indira Gandhi's moves to a more socialized system of government. But in the immediate years post-independence, they felt that, you know, nothing would change. I mean, again, this sounds unpleasant to say it, but there were probably some people who saw business opportunities in partition. As I said, it sounds unpleasant to say this, but then you have to remember that business people, by their nature, are opportunists. Business people have to make the best of whatever opportunities fall into their lap. So while they may not welcome the sudden changes, it's something, in a sense, business people are trained or anticipate doing. And many business people did just that. And even when they might seem to have lost out, And, you know, one example of this, to be honest, is our very own company, Bennett Coleman, because the Sahu Jain Company, who now own Bennett Coleman, the Jain family, had made their money in jute in Calcutta. But post-partition, I mean, they saw the end of the jute industry approaching, and they started looking for other avenues, and newspapers were one of them. And so I said, we are ourselves a great example of a company that saw the writing on the wall and changed because of partition. And, you know, many other companies were temporarily hit by the loss of the agro commodities from Pakistan. But there were two things. One is many Indian business communities were already in quite a good position because they had made, many of them had done quite well out of World War II. World War II, you know, except for a few fringes like Northeast India, the war never actually came to India. And India became a great resource of material, of products, of supply for the rest of the Allied war effort. And many Indian business people did very well out of World War II. So they were sitting on a fair amount of cash, which would help tide them through the chaos of partition. And some of them did well.
Sure. You mentioned about the Mahindra partnership sort of crumbling during this period. Mm-hmm. Who were the people who chose to stay back? Any names that you can give us? Because it's quite well known that Jinnah was actively courting Muslim businessmen to sort of move to Pakistan.
As I said, there were not that many Muslim business, really big Muslim businessmen to start with. Some of the biggest were actually in Hyderabad, which was a completely different can of worms altogether. Hyderabad at that time had resisted Jinnah's attempts to join Pakistan and was trying to set itself up as an independent state. So, you know, many of the business people from Hyderabad were in Hyderabad. Beyond that, you see, another thing one has to remember is that many people didn't realize how final partition would be. Because, you know, when we were talk came up about two countries, people assumed that, you know, very few people foresaw the horrors that would happen. And many people optimistically hoped that, you know, two countries could be created and they could continue to trade with each other. Because obviously that made sense. I mean, you know, the jute could keep coming from East Pakistan to West Bengal. So many, many people assumed that things could go on and they could go back and forth. And in fact, until around 1963 and the first Indo-Chinese War, there was actually a lot of back and forth movement between India and Pakistan. It was only after that, when things became bad, that all that stopped. And several Muslim business people seem to have taken a decision to have a foot in both camps. So one son would be sent to Pakistan, one son would stay in India. One example is Hamdard, the makers of Ruh Afza. You know, the family sent one son to Pakistan to make Ruh Afza, then one son stayed in India to make Ruh Afza here. Bigger example is actually the Azim Premji family, where Azim Premji himself and his father decided to stay in India, but one brother went to Pakistan. So there were a few cases like that, but ultimately not that many.
Sure. I don't think I can look at Ruh Afza the same way anymore. You know, I didn't know all of this, and it's just having this conversation in itself is so enlightening. What about those who came as refugees? We've spoken about established businessmen in a sense, but there were so many people who came as refugees with absolutely nothing in their pockets and just one suitcase, maybe sometimes not even that. What are some of the household names or brands that came up after these people who were displaced from their homes was sort of forced to start from scratch in a sense? You mentioned, you know, Hamdard is one name that we all know, but anything else?
So this is where the impact was really felt, with the sort of small businessman who had just, a very local business and, you know, who didn't really have the resources to anticipate partition and who basically lost everything and had to flee with what they have. And many of their stories are completely horrific and the tragedies are immense. But again, you know, keep in mind, business people learn how to make the best of things and take advantage of things. And in one sense, the change did throw up opportunities. So, for example, the change in Punjab meant people left villages and very small towns and by and large went to cities in India, to large cities. So one side effect of partition was a sudden rapid growth in urbanization in North India. And that automatically meant opportunities because, you know, people in urban areas will buy things that people in villages will not. And I think the best example of this is MDH Masala, the famous brand of masalas. And that story, I think, says it all for that kind of businessman. I mean, the gentleman who started Mahishe Dharampal fled partition with, I think, just like 1,500 rupees in his pocket. And I think he left behind family who he never was able to contact again. And he came to Delhi. And basically, you know, in Punjab, in undivided Punjab, he had tried his hand at many businesses. He had tried selling mirrors, doing little bits of like manufacturing. But his family business was in masalas as wholesale traders. And so finally, when he came to Delhi, Mahishe Dharampal, who is actually, he became much famous in later life when he became the face of MDH Masala. And, you know, you've seen him in many TV commercials with his big turban and, you know, I've seen that. Well, you know, his story is interesting. I mean, he came to Delhi and decided what could he do to make money. So the first thing he bought was actually he bought a tonga, a horse-drawn cart. And he started his life as a tonga driver and making a little bit of money to like keep himself in business. But then he also realized that there was an opportunity with spices, because suddenly all these people in who had lived in villages in Punjab and who would bought spices once or two times a year or even grown some of them themselves, suddenly they were in cities cut off from all of that. And as I said, urbanization is a huge driver of business opportunities. So that's exactly what happened with Mahishe Dharampal. He realized that suddenly with all these people who were now living in big cities, there was a great new market for his spices. So he invested some of his remaining money and what he could make from the tonga into buying spices and then selling spices and then selling spice blends and packeted spices, which again was a concept he would probably not have been able to do in his original home, because in the small towns and villages, nobody bought packet masala. Everybody, you know, would grind the masala for themselves. But suddenly in the urban life that these people had been plunged into, where often the women also had to work, you know, there was suddenly a demand for packaged spices. And Mahishe Dharampal was smart enough to see this opportunity. And he benefited from it and he became MDH Masala as it is today.
That's fascinating and such a great story to share. Thank you so much. What were the rules, the corporate rules and regulations at the time when this phase of transition was taking place?
You know, not really very much. I mean, the British kept their hands off the business community. One thing that actually helped Indian businessmen was actually the Swatantra movement. Because Gandhi had from very early on, from the 1920s onwards, as a way to challenge British rule, had pushed Indian businessmen to start producing commodity products in India so that we didn't have to buy British commodities. That actually was a big advantage for Indian businessmen. And it's something you actually don't see in many other parts of the world post the end of imperialism. Many countries, like say the you know countries in Africa, did not have this base of industrialization and base of local production of commodities. And so, you know, continued to be dependent on Western commodities for a long time. But in India, for example, you know, one great example is Godrej. I mean, Godrej was, you know, very cleverly rode the wave of the Swaraj movement and started producing products made in India for India. And, you know, for instance, one way they did it was with soaps, because, you know, there was always this fear that Western soaps used animal fats. So Godrej produced a soap that only used, I mean, that's what they advertised itself as, only using vegetable fats. Now, this is not entirely correct because the Unilever soaps also use vegetable fats. But Godrej saw this as an opportunity to sell something, a product made in India by Indians for Indians, and sold themselves very aggressively on the fact that we don't use animal fat, we only use vegetable fat. So, you know, the Godrejes are a great example of a company that had started indigenization of production even pre-partition. And that gave the business community a great base. So, you know, it was one thing that really helped the Indian business and Indian markets when independence actually arrived.
Sure. And what about Pakistan? Did they have similar rules that came into play later on, or were they completely different? Anything about that?
So to some extent, actually, there was a long period when Pakistan was seen as a better business bet because it had a more business-friendly government. But that actually has changed because Pakistan made the big mistake, which we never did, of allowing the military to get involved in industrial production.
Right.
And now this has created a sort of monster of itself where there is this big military-industrial nexus which now effectively controls the state. And, you know, the military has too many profits coming from its industrial ventures to just step back and give up control of the state. I mean, we avoided that. And that is actually something huge and something important to remember, because it was a trap we could have fallen into easily. One could argue, for example, that Sri Lanka is falling into this trap too now, with the military increasingly part of the economy. We in India kept the military out of politics, and we kept the military out of industry while still completely respecting the military for what it could do. And I think that has been one of the key reasons for our success all around.
Interesting. When we speak about, you know, how businessmen really arranged capital and funds, what were the banks that lent funds to business people at that point? Or how did they go about it?
I mean, there were a range of banks. I mean, you know, and the British did leave us with a fairly developed banking system. There was the Imperial Bank, which became the State Bank of India. And again, part of this was there were all the princely state banks. I mean, this is perhaps time to remember the importance, to some extent, that the princely states played in India. We always forget, you know, that the princely states were a huge part of India. And actually, they were fairly important for business. I mean, we have this image of the princely states as being the sort of dissolute, luxury-loving sort of bunch. And that was certainly true. But there were many who actually promoted business, especially the large states like Mysore and Hyderabad and Travancore. And many of the sort of aristocrats in these business states had a lot of disposable income, which they could invest in real estate. A lot of Bombay real estate was subsidized by Indian princes, and also in business. And Pakistan, on the other hand, had very few princely states. There were just a couple, Bhawalipur and a few others that joined Pakistan. And the princely states did serve as important sources of finance to some extent. I don't want to overstate their importance, but the network of finances, like, you know, all the, I mean, now that it's all part of State Bank of India, but, you know, there were all the state banks of India, of Hyderabad and Mysore, etc., which were part of the princely states. That's an indication of the importance of these multiple sources of financing had.
You know, the British never believed that India could manage on its own, but we've seen countless stories of how people really came together during these tough times. In the article that you spoke about, you mentioned Faridabad. Could you tell us a little bit more about how it came to be?
Well, Faridabad was just a small settlement on the Grand Trunk Road, really. But it was identified as being a good place to set up a large resettlement camp for refugees from Pakistan. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, people like Kamala Devi Chattopadhyay, you know, worked, who did so much incredible work. You know, we forget that, you know, one reason why partition was horrible, it could have been much, much worse for the refugees who came to India. And it wasn't partly because of two sets of people. One is the Indian administrators in the civil service and other parts of the administration of independent India, who did an incredible job in giving refugees a place in India. Right from, you know, giving refugees a vote, which was an incredibly progressive decision taken by bureaucrats in the Indian government. Refugees were also resettled across India. Places like Faridabad were created. And this is where, you know, organizations like Kamala Devi Chattopadhyay and many incredible women who worked in refugee resettlement helped these refugees settle and start communities. I mean, in the case of Faridabad, if I remember correctly, Kamala Devi Chattopadhyay actually found an electric plant which had been abandoned in Calcutta. And, you know, again, this was, again, an unexpected benefit of the end of the World War II, that a lot of material, you know, what we call the stuff that the armies use, had just been left in India, and a lot of this could be used. So this, she managed to get this power-generating plant all the way to Faridabad and managed to set it up and even call Nehru to inaugurate it. And Faridabad had power. And, you know, there are many examples of incredible people who worked to help resettle refugees like this. And Faridabad and places like that are examples.
Right. You know, to kind of get back to the larger topic of business people during this period, if I had to ask you one character trait that they had in common, what do you think that would be? Because they've built such strong, resilient businesses that have truly stood the test of time. What do you think they had in common?
Well, you've just said it yourself, resilience. I mean, that was it, really. They had incredible resilience. I mean, they had faced this cataclysmic blow. They had works and their homes and their lives, and in many cases, their families were taken away from them. And they had to just spring back into action. So there was an incredible amount of resilience. And yes, they received help, as I said, from the Indian state, from volunteer organizations, and so on. And there were certain advantages that India had at that time. But mostly it was this incredible resilience of the business community who helped them build themselves up again after partition.
And, you know, at a time where we're talking about unsustainable business models and, you know, a startup bubble and those kinds of things, what do you think founders of today can really learn from founders of that time?
I mean, I suppose the thing to keep in mind is, as you said, resilience and the need to keep yourself ready for whatever changes can come. I mean, what is very clear is that, you know, we are living and heading in for even more turbulent times. We may not be facing partition, but we are facing climate change on an unprecedented scale. And we have very little idea how, you know, things like climate change or the new political instability, you know, that's coming out because of Russian and Chinese aggression is going to affect us. There is so little that's clear. But as I said, I mean, we can take inspiration from the people who survived partition. You know, partition came like a thunder blow out of nowhere, really, for them. And right. Many of them lost everything and had to restart, and they managed. I mean, as I said, look at Sri Lanka, what is happening in Sri Lanka now. Who would have imagined a country could collapse as fast as that? And that's a lesson, you know, for us not to be complacent. I mean, yes, there are special consequences in, context in Sri Lanka, which don't apply in India. But the lesson really is that you can never take your lives for granted. And that's what happened with partition.
When these businesses were being built, do you feel like a lot got left behind? I mean, there still remains a very high amount of a colonial hangover in our old school work ethic, in a sense, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, in many ways, it became even worse. I mean, the sort of Boxwala culture that the British brought was very happily taken up by Indian managers and persisted, you know, well into the 60s and 70s. And I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was a very cushy job for many decades, you know, well into the 80s. And it was a very small community. Everybody knew each other. It was not very competitive. And I think we really start seeing a shakeup happen in the 80s with the dawn of companies like the Ambanis and many other new Indian business companies, which really shook these old British companies. You saw the collapse of the managing agency system, which was actually a pretty bad system. You know, it was like it allowed a small board of managers to control a very large and diverse range of businesses, and often not very well. And there was this abrupt shock that happened in the 80s when people like Manu Chabria and all that came and just shook up the management agencies, took them over, kicked out the old managers. And it was a much needed change. You know, people talk about the heritage of ITC and all bullshit. Okay. I mean, companies like that really needed a shakeup, and that really started happening after the 80s.
As Vikram said, we may not be faced by a partition, but we are staring at extremely uncertain times. Be it climate change or the looming fear of an economic recession, now, more than ever before, we need businesses to embody the spirit of resilience. Business owners, founders, and entrepreneurs of today could take a leaf out of the books of all those who set up businesses during the early days of independence and dealt with all kinds of flux, be it political, economical, or even regulatory. Some failed, many prospered. New ones took the place of the old. But it's key to understand the value of patience in building institutions. Like countries, they too take time to prosper, and that is why what matters most is the foundation. On the 75th anniversary of our Independence Day, we hope you like the stories of our business bazigars. This is your host, Diya Rekhi, signing off. This episode was produced by Sumit Pandey from The Economic Times and Swati Joshi from Awaaz. Sound editing was done by Rajas Nayak and Indraneel Bhattacharji from The Economic Times. Executive producers Anupriya Bahadur and Adijit Barman. If you liked this episode, please make sure to share it on your social media.
And do tune in to ET Play, our latest platform for all audio content, including The Morning Brief. On account of Independence Day, The Morning Brief will not air on Tuesday. You'll hear from us again on Thursday and Friday. All external sound clips used in this episode belong to their respective owners. Credits are mentioned in the description. Goodbye and a happy Independence Day from all of us at Team Morning Brief.